Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Philosophy in Action. I'm Greg Perkins, here with philosopher Dr. Diana Shea, where we answer your questions, applying rational principles to the challenges of real life. For those listening to the podcast, please join us live, where there's a text chat to chime in with your follow-up questions and witty comments. The show airs Sunday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 9 a.m. Mountain, 10 a.m. Central, and 11 a.m. Eastern Time at philosophyinaction.com. At the site, you can also submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows and browse the archives from past shows. Now, with all of that out of the way, let's jump over to the star of the show, Dr. Diana Shea. All right. Happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday. Welcome, everybody. What topics do we have on tap this week, Greg?
Okay. We have a great set of questions on needs versus wants, medical care for the poor, and more.
Remember, if you're listening live, you can post questions and comments over in the text chat that's at philosophyinaction.com/live.
Okay, what's been going on this week?
I actually have just been working on personal projects, so pretty much no news to report. We can just get right down to the questions.
Getting straight to business. Okay. 1 second here. Conga time. Needs versus wants. Is the distinction between needs and wants valid? Anti-capitalist philosophers such as,
Gilles Deleuze.
I know. I'm going to write that down, too. Anyway, accuse the capitalist system of depending on blurring the distinction between needs and wants and tyrannizing over us by implanting artificial needs into our minds. In contrast, George Riesman justifies capitalist extravagance on the basis that human needs are technically infinite and that our needs expand as we become more affluent. Who is right? Is the distinction between needs and wants valid or not? Is it useful in thinking about ethics or politics?
Okay, so what I want to do is start with the standard view of needs versus wants. And this is from a social studies for kids website. So it's sort of a basic economics section. And this was the number one Google search result for needs versus wants. So that's why I chose that. Okay, so here's what they say. Quote, a need is something you have to have, something you can't do without. A good example is food. If you don't eat, you won't survive for long. Many people have gone days without eating, but they eventually ate a lot of food. That cracked me up. You might not need a whole lot of food, but you do need to eat. Close quote. It's a funny discussion. It's just if you don't eat food for a certain amount of time, you are going to die, right? I don't know why they just didn't say that. Anyway, a want. Quote, a want is something you would like to have. It's not absolutely necessary, but it would be a good thing to have. A good example is music. Now, some people might argue that music is a need because they think they can't do without it. But you don't need music to survive. You do need to eat. Close quote. So given this conceptual framework, I think it's really easy for people to think, well, sure, your own needs, they might come first, right? That's okay. Put your own needs first. But surely other people's needs should come before your mere wants. So if other people are lacking food and you're just lacking music, well, too bad for you. It would be wrong for you to go buy that music on iTunes when you could be giving that money to the other person or having it taken away from you by the government in order to buy them food. And, so this is why we have this idea in part of taxes on wealth, taxes on income, because, look, it's one thing for you to, you need to earn enough to survive. But beyond that, we should be taking out money. We should be putting that money to better use so that it's satisfying other people's needs rather than your mere frivolous personal wants. And then what we see are these arguments about periodically you see is basically is high-speed internet and smartphones. Like, are these a genuine need in our current society such that they're we should treat them as an entitlement and provide them to the poor at taxpayer expense and so on. And so this is how these arguments tend to go.
It does get interesting. Okay, how would you distinguish needs versus wants?
Yeah, so here what I want to do is just focus on needs versus wants in the context of the endeavor of life itself. But you can also apply this distinction to lesser goals like becoming a good salsa dancer. Like, what is it you need to do that? What is it that you want? Or cooking really good meatloaf. What is, you really need beef, but mushrooms, maybe that's just a mere want in your meatloaf. So we can look at those in more particular goals. But here I want to focus on this endeavor of life itself, needs versus wants. Okay, so in our production meeting, Greg and I, we really struggled somewhat on this. And we ended up with the view that that a person's needs are the absolute, the universal, the very basic requirements of life and flourishing. And then the wants are things that are more optional bells and whistles, things that are oftentimes, they're helpers, but they're often reflecting of one's own preferences and so on. And, that was all right. Seemed like there was a difference in priority, let's say, between needs versus wants. You better make sure your needs are satisfied, and then you get to your wants. But what I ended up, after that production meeting, I had a conversation with Arthur Zay about this, and because he said, I want to talk to you about this because I've got a way that I distinguish this, which actually seems to make sense to people, and which makes better sense of this distinction. So he said his basic view was that needs are metaphysical facts about the requirements of survival. Again, things like food and shelter and a lot of other stuff too. Whereas wants are recognitions of and desires for those needs. So I thought that was, that's fairly interesting. And he said, obviously, you should only want what you actually need, broadly understood. And so, it's important to make sure that your wants are rational, that they are actually things that are requirements for your life and happiness. And so the more that I thought about it, here's what I came up with. Needs are the universal requirements for sustaining human life. They're what every person requires to survive and flourish. And needs don't just concern bare physical survival, like we saw in the quote from that social studies website. They're not just air and food and water and shelter. This is one of Ayn Rand's really important insights about ethics, about the foundations of ethics and so on, is that humans need much more than that, need in a really important, really genuine way that our life requires more than just physical sustenance. Humans live by reason. We live by trade. We live by division of labor. And so if we're going to do those things effectively, a person really does have to tend to the needs of his mind. And if he fails to do so, he is going to die. So a person does need to seek out knowledge. A person needs to learn to communicate effectively. A person needs to develop principles inductively. A person needs friendship and love. A person needs life-affirming art and so on. And these pursuits, the pursuit of these values and everything necessary to them, these are actually genuine and important human needs. But that doesn't mean that everything that we do in pursuit of life and happiness, which should be everything that we do, there should be nothing that we do that's not pursuing life and happiness in our lives. It doesn't mean that everything counts as a need. That would actually, that wouldn't be really helpful if we just said, because then we just say, look, all life-affirming activities are all life-affirming values are needs. There's something to this needs versus wants distinction, something else going on. So what I would say is that wants are the particular ways that we satisfy our needs based on our own context and preferences and resources. So they're not the universal thing. They're the particular thing. They're the thing particular to you and your circumstances. And that's why, in part, they often seem, well, these are not so important, because you have options. There's other ways of satisfying these needs. Other people satisfy these needs in other ways. But this is how you are saying, this is my path here. That's what wants are. So a person needs knowledge to live, but there's this question, well, what should you study? What should you actually focus on? Well, that's going to depend on your life circumstances, your interests, and so on. And if you're a yeoman peasant in 1600 England, in the England in 1600s, like you darn well better study agriculture. Like that's the thing you actually need to know about. But if you're me, I have tons of options, right? And so I can study philosophy and psychology and history and all kinds of other things. And somebody else, like Paul, is much more interested in math and physics and other kinds of stuff of that sort. Similarly, I have a need for art. Like that's the need. That's the universal. And I can say, well, look, music is this is probably my favorite art form. And right now, I can say, look, I'm listening to a lot of a singer named Robin, and I have her album Body Talk, but I really want to go buy her earlier albums. But I'd say, yeah, those are a want, not a need. Like, I need art, but I wouldn't say that I need this particular, these particular albums. Like, I know, yes, they'll enhance my life and my happiness. They'll make me more resilient. They'll put me in better touch with my emotions. But in fact, I have thousands of other songs already that I could listen to, and there's lots of other great albums that I could buy. So there's lots of options there. And so I wouldn't say that these particular albums, they're not a need. I don't have to have them, or, you know, or my life is going to be imperiled in some way. No, they're a want. That doesn't mean they're unimportant, but the want is the way of satisfying the need. Similarly, we all need food, right? But you might want this particular steak off the menu right now. And we all need a career, but you might want to be an architect, and so on. And so I think that's in part the distinction that we're getting at. This is, it sort of makes sense of common usage and makes sense of the philosophical background, the philosophical principles that we know. At least that's my hope with this. So Greg, I don't know, you have any thoughts on this? Because I did spring this on you like 4 minutes before the broadcast.
Well, I think this is it's nice in a certain way, and it doesn't get us past another problem. So when we were in the production meeting, what's really the problem here is that it goes back to we were discussing how people are basically manipulating each other using this kind of thing. It's like, okay, when the language of that's a want, not a need, comes out of someone, they're really trying to say to somebody else, I don't like your choice of how to satisfy this requirement of human survival. I don't like the way you're I think that you're making either a mistake in how you're choosing to pursue your life, or I'd like to harness you to serve mine. There's something like that usually going on, because the distinction here, it's like, well, okay, the way you're talking about needs and wants right now doesn't actually align with the way that people are using it. They're thinking of concrete versus concrete, not metaphysical human requirements for human survival and its various expressions. So in one sense, I like how it reframes it and guides people to getting rid of this goofy distinction that's just a manipulation, it seems like. So this is nice. It's great in that sense. You can say, oh, no, needs are what's required for humans to survive, and that can take a lot of forms, and the wants are the forms I'm choosing. Now, if you're going to say that my want is not a good want, you can talk with me about my hierarchy of values and whether I'm making a mistake, and then that'll lead down to the you should be serving all of your neighbors and this and that and the other thing, because in a sense, you can never have too much resilience, you can never have too much happiness, you can never have too much knowledge, all that we discussed. So I like how it's reframing it. It can guide people to thinking in a better way and getting rid of that, or at least revealing the goofy manipulation that might be going on, if it is. So that part's great.
Yeah, I mean,
doesn't
I will
get rid
say,
of the debate, I guess.
Yeah, it doesn't, just, and it can't.
It reveals it.
Yeah, you can't get rid of the debate. Now, Arthur says in the chat, I want to, because he and I didn't talk at super length about this. We certainly didn't talk about it after I thought about it some more. He said, basically that his statement of metaphysical facts, that they concern particulars, they can concern particulars too. So, for example, if I want to lose weight, then I need to restrict my caloric intake. So there are identifications of causal relationships, it looks like, here. Basically, he says, quote, I use need to essentially be synonymous with the ideas of requirements or dependence. Want is an identification of a desire. Close quote. So I can see where he's going. I can see where he's going with that. I don't know. You know, it's
I that's my general reaction. I really think it's a great way to defuse the goofiness in people's thinking and guide them to a better way to talk about it. I like this.
I don't know.
I'm
just
take it and use it. Thank
at
you,
least, at least it seems like, okay, let's start the conversation in this direction. I'm not, I'm, you know, it's sometimes really difficult to work through these. And it's hard sometimes to make, because I have dual goals here, right? One, to make sense of the way that people use these terms. And two, to make sense of, to be compatible with what we know philosophically, which is, in particular in this case, that things like art and friendship and communication are not optional, right? You really do need these to live. These are absolute requirements, requirements to live.
Yeah.
And so I think that's part of the issue. And there is, what I would say about needs versus wants is it seems like the essential that people are getting at when they use these terms is this thing is absolutely required versus this thing is optional. And I think what I'm trying to do is shed light on the way in which it's optional. Well, it might be optional, like you might think it's optional for me, but it might really be the absolute best thing for my life and happiness. Telling me that this is optional. No, this in a way, this is not optional for me. It's optional from the perspective of humanity at large in that people can reasonably choose different things, but this isn't optional for me.
And that goes to very often people universalize their own particular value hierarchy.
I can eat all vegetables. Why can't you?
Yeah. So think of here's the unit economy in this, and I like it. I really do. Universal requirements of human survival. That's a lot of syllables. Needs, one syllable. That's pretty important. So I'm good with that. Needs are that. And now wants are the particular expression. And if somebody's going to try to tell me I need to do something different, great. We're going to be talking about actual hierarchies of values and the choices that are being made. And I think that's great. It'll reveal very quickly whether or not you have a goofy standard, like some altruist thing, or whether they're asking you to sacrifice, or if they just don't understand your context well enough, or they don't understand just how varied the expression or the satisfaction of a need can be.
Right.
And okay.
I mean, I will say
that's wonderful.
One of the ways that objectivists have tended to talk about this is in terms of optional values, like versus moral values. So moral values are the universal requirements of human life, and optional things are the things that people can differ on. But I dislike that language almost as much as the standard way of using needs versus wants, because children, they're an optional value. And that's true in the sense that for some people, children are like super important. For other people, I really don't want to have kids, and there's people in the middle, right? So it's not like universally everybody should have children or nobody should have children or like every third person should have children, right? That's not the right way of seeing it. But it's also not the case for, it's not necessarily optional for any particular person, right? For some people, it might really be like, this is necessary to my life and happiness. And for other people, it might be not having kids is really necessary for my life and happiness. For other people, it might be optional for them. Like they could go either way. And so that's why I dislike the language of that. And so in a way, I'm trying to solve that problem too. I'm trying to get a vocabulary so that we can talk about these kinds of values, which are really important, and yet not quite part of the ethical debate in a way. And that makes life difficult.
Yeah. So Jen notes that she's hesitant, and she likes a lot of this, but she's hesitant to make the default assumption that this is only or primarily a thinking problem. And I don't think that's the case. I think what's going on is people have some messed up values some bad training, and this is the result of it. I think that this kind of distinction is used to obscure what they're up to, and it's nice to have a way to defuse that way of obscuring it and just reveals, like, what are we really talking about here?
Yeah,
and
I'm not sure
to the problem.
I'm not sure what she means by primarily a thinking problem. I think there's a lack of conceptual clarity, and there's moral agendas going on in terms of people wanting to push a certain.
I was assuming she was just saying that it was about not having this distinction to use. And once you give them this distinction, problem goes away. And it's like,
definitely not.
This just makes it so that we can actually find the problem instead of having it hidden.
Right, right.
Yeah. So there's a sub question in here.
Let me say one more thing. I think one of the most important things here is simply to reject this idea that a person's wants are frivolous. Well, A, I'd say to reject the idea that a person's needs are only about physical survival, and B, to thereby reject everything, or to say basically wants are frivolous. That's not actually true. First of all, it's really important to not be materialist about things and recognize that the human mind is our basic means of survival. It has requirements. It has genuine and seriously important needs. And wants, the in a way, the more the less we are just satisfying needs in some kind of like barely minimal way, the more elaborate wants we have. Not always, but as a general thing, the more resilient we are. So that's all good. So don't denigrate
wants. There's something to the hierarchy of needs where it's like, okay, you need to be metabolizing for the next minute.
Right.
And beyond that, you also need, and that's what the hierarchy is. It goes as you go up the layers of the hierarchy, you're becoming more and more resilient so that you can take much more of a hit as you go up the up the line. You have much more variability.
You know, it's funny, just as a side comment, I've noticed this lately. Greg, I'm getting the echo, by the way. I've noticed this lately as sort of my life has been, I feel like I've blown up my life in a lot of ways lately. And it's funny because I've been doing things like I am more prone to making mistakes because of the stress that I'm under. So recently I almost put gas in my diesel truck. You can imagine how well that would have worked out. And there's other things, like a friend of mine who's also going through a whole lot of relationship turmoil, got two cars towed like in a month. But like, this is one of the things that happens when you're under a whole lot of stress. You make more mistakes of this kind. And so having that resilience, having the financial resources, having the health resources, having this overabundance with which to compensate for the mistakes that you will make when times get really tough, this is really, really important. And I've only really noticed this lately. I mean, just how much the cognitive overhead of being under stress makes you I'm sorry, I'm searching for the right word. It makes you
more
make
brittle.
Mistakes. Yeah, it's not quite brittle, and so you need that extra resilience. You need that overabundance. So
yeah, and it's even mundane stuff. If you're being stressed, in that maybe you're being hit with a bunch of stimulus or a time requirement, it can muck up the works. It makes it so that it's harder for you to get things right and be smooth.
Yes.
All right. So a sub question that arrived, are our needs unlimited?
So I think no, in one sense, like in the sense that there are these universal requirements of human life, and we can specify pretty much what those are. And we know what those are, but there's no limits to the ways in which we can satisfy our needs and how well we can satisfy our needs. In other words, there's no limit to our rational wants or the options that we have in satisfying our needs. And you know, that's a really, really great thing. Like, really great. It means that humans are making, because of capitalist innovation and so on, we are making great progress in this task of promoting human well-being. And we are doing better and better, which means that people can, not that they always do, people can live better today than they ever have before in all of human history. And that is really important. That is a really good thing that deserves celebration. And like, yes, people can make all kinds of mistakes in this area. I mean, there are lots of people who think that, well, I'll be so happy if I can just own that fancy car or have this fabulous house or whatever it is. They place their happiness in material objects in a way that is actually harmful to their life overall. But those kinds of mistakes don't prove that pursuing wants or having big wants are destructive or that capitalism is corrupt or anything. No, they just prove that people need to learn to better identify and cultivate their rational wants so that they will truly and deeply and meaningfully satisfy their needs and not actually harm themselves in the pursuit of irrational desires. And that is the task of ethics. It's the task of psychology, too. And I think it's harder than it might seem to get these kinds of things right. It feels like everything is harder than it might have seemed to me a few months ago. I've got this appreciation for how difficult these kinds of things can be now. And that's really important. That's hard work for people to do. And, yeah, they screw up. And hopefully they get better.
Well, so here's the thing. Living a life is like an engineering trade-off. Your time is limited. Your resources are limited. Your hierarchy of needs, values is what it is. And you could be serving that or making a mistake and sacrificing things unnecessarily. And so that's when you're messing up. But in there is a sense in which needs are unlimited. you have a need for that resilience. You need the requirements of human survival. You could never have too much resilience, which to me translates to you can never have too much knowledge, too much material value, material wealth to throw at problems and make yourself safer. In a certain sense, you can never have too much of those things, but you can certainly mess up by pursuing more of this or that than you should. If I pursue nothing but knowledge, I starve. If I pursue nothing but money, which in many contexts can be a great tool, if I mindlessly pursue that, I'm sabotaging other values. So there's two different discussions here, it seems like. One is that, well, yeah, that you can never have it's silly to say you should not try to have so much happiness or so much knowledge. No, it's always in the context of your values. Are you sabotaging your life? That would be like saying, you can have too much life. And it's like, well, no, I can't have too much life. I can mess up my life. I can make it unnecessarily short. I can. It's needs are not the kind of thing. These base requirements of human survival, or the metaphysical requirements of human survival, it's not an amount. And so it's kind of like talking about eternity. It's not forever. It's just not about time.
Right.
And here it's like, well, a particular expression, I could muck up my life, but really basic values, I can't say that there's too much of this or that. It's always relative to what I my whole hierarchy of values and how I'm pursuing my whole life.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, absolutely. Yeah. So, yes and no is what I would say. You can't have too much knowledge, but if you pursue too much knowledge at the expense of other important things, well, yeah, that's too much for you.
Right.
All right. So that's an awful lot to think about. What's the take-home point?
So needs are the universal requirements for sustaining human life, which they're what every person requires to survive and flourish. Wants are the particular ways that a person desires to satisfy his needs based on his own context and preference and resources. Needs and wants do not differ merely in importance, and a person's rational wants should not be regarded as unimportant. I just want to say, so Arthur's been talking in the chat, and I want to give a little bit more time to his quote what he's saying here, because I think it's important for his view, which I'm leaning more and more towards. So he says, here's a statement of a need. To pass my exam, I need to study. And a statement of want. To pass my exam, I want to study. Now, these are not equivalent, right? And it's not just a matter of universal versus particular. I would agree with that. It's a statement. The first one's a statement of metaphysical fact, of like the causation. And the other one's a statement of one's desire. And obviously, you can say, to pass my exam, I need to study, but I actually don't want to. That's perfectly reasonable to say. And you can still go ahead and do it anyway. Anyway, so he says there it's not a matter of scope or degree or particularity, and I would agree with that. So I want to think about this more. I think that there needs to be better language around these things in general, around these universal versus particular values, around our desires for things versus the requirements of life. That would be really great to get some of that nailed down in a clear way.
Nice. All right, any other follow-up? If not, it's time for the reminder about the tip jar.
So Philosophy in Action Radio, not just the live show, but the podcast too, is available to anyone free of charge. That's because we want to spread rational principles far and wide. We do that with every show to thousands of listeners, but we can't accomplish that alone. We do rely on the support of our fans. So if you value our work, please do contribute to our tip jar. You can visit philosophyinaction.com/support to send money online or via the mail. We suggest $5 per episode or $20 per month, but any amount is welcome. And you can also create a recurring monthly tip via PayPal, Dwolla, or your bank's bill pay. Then you don't need to remember, and you also get free access to Philosophy in Action's premium content, and we really appreciate that regular support. Again, you can do all that at philosophyinaction.com/support.
Medical care for the poor. How would the poor obtain medical care in a free society? In your May 12, 2013 show, you discussed how the law that obliges emergency rooms and doctors to treat patients regardless of ability to pay violates the rights of doctors and results in worse care for the poor. But what is the alternative? How would the poor and indigent get medical care, if at all, in a society without government welfare programs? What if charity wasn't sufficient?
So the alternative to government welfare is private charity, and it's market innovation in particular. And there are lots and lots of forms that that might take. And unfortunately, many of those today are hampered or just completely blocked by the government as part of their scheme to make welfare work. So in particular, some options here. Things like low-cost clinics. Unfortunately, government regulations make these very hard to run cheaply. Cheap catastrophic insurance. This is just outright forbidden by the government through various mandates. Doctors charging fees on a sliding scale, whereby, you know, look, if you're poor, you pay less than somebody who has more income. And my understanding is that government regulations outright forbid this if you accept Medicare. And Paul might be able to say something in the chat about that. I forgot to ask him beforehand about whether that was the case. Obviously, private charities. And these exist, but they don't exist, I think, in the numbers that they would if we didn't already have government welfare. Because right now, people assume, look, you've got a problem, go get on the dole. And that'll be that.
And the government welfare system drains your resources that you might put towards those sorts of things.
Right, right. And then also you have the resources of friends and family. And plus now what we also are seeing, which I really like, is crowdsourcing being used to raise money for medical costs. And I'm really glad to see that those social connections coming to some good use. But I think what we have to recognize here is that the whole healthcare system in the United States, particularly the financial side, is insane, and it's a product of government. There is no such thing as a free market. All prices are based on Medicare prices, which are set by government bureaucrats. Regulations are overwhelming and super-duper costly to doctors, to hospitals, to insurance companies, to everybody else. Drugs requires decades of costly approval with the FDA, and so on and so on and so on. There are so many layers of regulations and controls and cost, you know, price setting and so on, that most people have no idea of. I mean, I'd say like 99% of people have no idea of. Even people who work in the medical field don't know all of them because they only see their slice of the pie.
And there's even other facets like sort of the monopolistic keeping competing sources of medical care out of the market. For example, you're not allowed to do certain things unless you're a certified doctor by the government.
Right.
Certified. So there's a whole range of activities that could be provided by other less costly means that are just prevented outright.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. And so I think it's a problem. It's an understandable problem that people can't see how charity could possibly take over government welfare in our current healthcare system. And they're right about that. It couldn't possibly. You couldn't possibly just eliminate Medicare, for example, and have the private sector take up that slack. You could not do it. There are too many government controls, too many government regulations that would make that impossible. And that's why the first priority here in terms of transitioning to a free market would be to ease up and eliminate all those regulations that drive up costs and make reasonable quality, low-cost medical care available to the poor. So first you do that, and then you phase out welfare programs. And I think that it's important here to recognize that a free market in healthcare would look very, very different from the current system. And it's important to look here at how markets function, right? We have a free market, or mostly free market, in shoes. And that means, yes, there are some of those fancy shoes that are available for $500, which I would never, ever buy, right?
They're ridiculous.
But the free market also offers $10 sneakers at Walmart, right? There's a huge range. Free markets don't just cater to the rich. They do cater to the rich, and actually one of the consequences of that is the development of new technology and so on that then makes those $10 sneakers ultimately possible. But that's not what we see. We don't have that kind of innovation. We don't have that kind of trickle-down effect in healthcare today, not because it's intrinsically impossible and healthcare has to be horribly expensive, but because providers are barred, almost completely barred, from innovating on the side of more affordable products and services. The government is just outright preventing them from doing that.
Yeah, there's it's so much interference. And there's also this notion floating around in the question that's like, well, just because the government doesn't do it doesn't mean that it can't or won't be done by anyone. It's kind of like on the shoe front. The Soviet Union provided shoes for people. And if you told people in the Soviet Union after they got used to that idea that, well, we're not going to have the government be providing shoes, people would be like, well, what, are we supposed to walk around barefoot? What about the poor? How will they get shoes? Well, that's exactly what's going on here with medicine and all the other stuff that our government has crowded out all of the market in.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it's really, once the government takes over something, it's really hard for people to imagine any way other than that. I mean, look at the post office. People think, how could it possibly, like, even though we have UPS and FedEx who come, you know, like, come to my house and deliver packages all the time, people still can't imagine how we would possibly survive without the Postal Service.
Yeah, and those were innovations that showed up despite the crowding out that the post office was doing. And the post office had monopolistic control over certain segments, and they still found ways to innovate and differentiate and impress us. And it's like, well, please, just go away, post office, and leave these guys free to kick some butt and bring me my postal mail in a whole new form. Or maybe it's not needed at all now with email.
You know, there was a startup in San Francisco which basically you would forward all your mail to them, and they would scan it in and email it to you, and they could, you know, filter out the junk and all that kind of stuff. So, which was awesome, right? And it solved that last mile problem, which it's so expensive to actually deliver the stuff to people in the last mile.
Yeah, it all goes to the warehouse, and you scan and email it to me. Thanks.
Yeah, isn't that awesome? Great. Well. Apparently, if I recall correctly, the Postal Service did not like this, and they shut them down. So, yeah.
Shocker.
I know. Surprise, surprise, right? But that's the kind of innovation that you would get in a free market. But that's not what we have.
This is that same old problem from economics of the seen and the unseen. People can see the direct things that the government does. What they can't see are all the things that were crowded out, all the innovations that could have been happening if you hadn't forced your one true solution on everyone.
Yeah. So Arthur says about this startup, you didn't even have to forward your mail to them. They would actually come to your mailbox, which, like, that's so inefficient, right? If you had the private firms delivering the mail in the first place, they could simply not deliver it. But the fact that that is possible, and instead what we have is the Postal Service, which 9 out of 10 of my pieces of mail are thrown in the trash.
Yeah. So. And what's crazy is that, again, a lot of that innovation is dealing with the thing that's being forced on us, the thing that nobody can get around. And it's like, well, gosh, if that weren't even there in the first place, what would we have?
Right.
It'd be awesome.
I also think it's worth remembering here that Medicare was not started because the poor were not getting care. It was not started because people were dying on the streets. They were being cared for in 1,000 different ways privately. Medicare was justified on the grounds that people getting such charity as charity is degrading and that it needs to be an entitlement. And yes, in private markets, there might be some people that fall through the cracks, and that's tragic. But you know what? Today, lots and lots and lots of people fall through the cracks too. And from stories that I've heard from people who work inside healthcare, sometimes they're stuffed into the tracks. Into the cracks to satisfy regulators. So the hospital needs to have, let's say, a certain percentage of recovery rates or something like that, you know, like 1 month out after surgery, blah, blah, blah. And they will do horrible things to patients. They will compromise patient care in order to get those numbers up, because if they don't have those numbers up, they're not going to get paid. And it's horrifying, but that's the kind of thing that happens. And so if you're somebody who's concerned about that, you want to make sure people don't fall through the cracks. That's great. Go ahead and take action, start a charity or support one, but don't advocate for ensnaring healthcare providers in these crazy Byzantine regulations, enriching crony companies, which is pretty much all insurance companies and hospitals today, and forcing taxpayers to foot the bill for this insanity. Don't do that. Actually, go out and help people. That would be something else.
Yeah, brings to mind they desire, say, a universal healthcare system, but even there, it's like, once you run out of other people's money, rationing starts.
Yep.
That's an awfully big crack to fall through.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And the problem is oftentimes people don't even know that they have fallen through the cracks. They don't know, well, look, if this technology is available elsewhere. And we see this actually in the U.S. with the FDA that, you know, by golly, your doctor can't help you. But if you were in Europe, there might be drugs that would be available that would be able to help your condition. But people just don't even know.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. Anything else?
Hang on a second. Let me just look at my notes. No, I think that's it.
All right. The take-home point then.
So the healthcare system in America today is largely a feature of Byzantine government regulations and controls. A robust system of charity would be possible in a genuinely free market.
All right. Look at this. It's a rapid-fire question time, and we have a big chunk of time to do this. I'll put Pine on the hot seat asking questions from this long and growing queue in any old order that strikes me by whim. And because we haven't had any time to really prep these, it could get a lot more interesting. So let's see what we have here. Hey, how can you maintain a close friendship with somebody if you don't like their spouse? Is it even possible?
Yes. Maybe. I mean, maybe a friendship, maybe not a close friendship, right? Because it reflects on the person that they're still married to this. You know, it reflects on, let's say it's a woman, it reflects on her that she is with somebody who you really find seriously distasteful. So you know, that might affect your relationship. I think that you can certainly see the person outside of, basically in a non-couples context. There's lots of people that I do activities with. Let's say if I have a horse friend that I go riding with that, I've met their boyfriend once and no idea about them, right? So you can have relationships that basically you don't interact with the spouse or don't interact with the spouse much. Even if you don't object to the spouse, right? I have no problem with my friend's boyfriend. He seems like a really nice guy, but he doesn't ride, so we don't hang out together. I don't know. But I think if you really hate the guy, and she's really in love with him, that's gotta be an issue.
I actually know personally someone in this circumstance where they're dear friends with the wife and absolutely despise and do not ever want to be near her husband, and that's a rough one.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
No advice there. Is that just doomed or?
I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. I think that there's like, it tells you something. The reason why people can be together, they can be together for all kinds of reasons. And I don't know. Like sometimes you can, depending on the context, sometimes you can work around that, and sometimes you can't. I don't know. Yeah. I think it's very particular. Like I would have to know, like if I was going to have this as a main question in the queue, I'd need to know more details about what exactly what's the problem here? What's the one spouse's view of the other? Why are they together? What's your relationship like? That kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, that's just not easily accessible too. All right. Moving on. This is an interesting one. What's the proper reaction of a girl who is being oogled and whistled at by guys in public? Is it a sign of lack of self-esteem if she enjoys it? Should the guy's behavior always be frowned upon?
God, I think I'm going to get in trouble for this. So, first of all,
this just,
yeah. First of all, I'm glad Arthur is here. He's going to help me out in the chat. So, first of all, there are ways of oogling and whistling that are really gross and offensive, and like one should not enjoy that. No matter what, in a way, right? That are seriously disrespectful and so on. But there's also ways that are just like, wow, you're attractive. And that's probably not oogling and whistling. That's, you know, having eye sex or something like that. But there's definitely ways of showing one's appreciation for the aesthetics of another person who's a stranger, right? That's not disrespectful and like, hey, honey, like, let's go in the back alley and get it on. And So there's a sort of like range of behaviors here, some of which are very objectionable and some of which are very benign. And the other thing is to say it's perfectly fine to want to be sexually attractive to people. It's perfectly fine. Sorry, I'm laughing at the stuff that's going on in the chat, because some of it's just like background context that jokes that we've made and so on. So it's perfectly fine to want to be sexually attractive to people and it's okay to want to be a sexual object in that way. Like not in the like care about you kind of way, but in the like holy crap, you're really attractive, you push my buttons. And so it's not a sign of lack of self-esteem if you enjoy having your physical form be appreciated by someone of the opposite sex. And whether or not the guy's behavior should be frowned upon depends upon the context. I mean, I think that there's a big difference, let's say, between clearly eyeing somebody, and this can be women eyeing men or men eyeing women or men eyeing men or women eyeing women, or, you know, whatever combination or whatever ambiguity you want in that. This can be, like, there are contexts in which that's more appropriate than others, and there's ways of doing it that are more appropriate than others. If you're doing that to a coworker, that's a problem, right? If your therapist is doing that to you, that's a problem. But there are other contexts in which it's basically people who are basically equals, and it's just not, it's not a big deal, and sure, it can be appreciated.
Did you see that video that was making the viral rounds of the lady who walked through, I think it was New York?
Yeah, I didn't. I saw it, like, I it popped up on my feed quite a number of times, but I didn't actually see it. I didn't watch it. What did you, did you see it? Did you watch it?
I did. Basically, she put on unadventurous clothes, just a black t-shirt and jeans, I think it was, backpack, did not make eye contact with anybody in the video as they presented it, and just walked the streets for, I don't know, several hours. And it was a constant stream of her being oogled, looked at. Sometimes people would kind of creepily walk along with her, trying to get her attention, or other times they would just, you know, turn around and look at her as she was walking past. Sometimes as she was approaching, she would get the wolf whistles and things like that.
Right.
A big range. And the presentation was basically saying that all of it was to be frowned upon and completely uncalled for.
I think there's a range. Like, looking at somebody is not, that's not inappropriate. But yeah, obviously lots of that is. And I also think there's a difference. Like, so the other night, y'all probably saw, or at least some people saw mine, the picture I posted on Facebook. Which I was going out to dinner with some friends, and I was in a slinky dress, and, like, I want to be noticed. If I'm wearing that, I want to be noticed. Like, the goal is to be noticed in that case, right? So you're not doing me any favors if you're averting your eyes in that case.
I've kind of noticed that there might be a goofy standard in there where I might put on fancy clothes, and or someone puts on fancy clothes, and they enjoy the attention of this person, but the next person's just a creepy perv. And it's right. Like, well, okay, they're both doing exactly the same thing. You just like this one and you don't like that one. And so now you frame what the first one does as great and what the second one does as wrong. And it's like, well, that doesn't seem too fair.
Right. Right. Yeah. Anyway, I think it's very contextual. There's definitely things that qualify as bad behavior. And I also think there's things that qualify as threatening behavior. So Arthur mentions in the chat, he's less likely to be intimidated given his stature, because Arthur's a big guy, right? And even though I'm 5'9", right, I'm reasonably muscular and so on, my ability to defend myself is pretty limited, and I know that. And so that would make me far more nervous, particularly if somebody is following me in some way. That would be an issue.
They're talking in the chat about all sorts of things. One of them was, Greg saw the slinky dress in, and it's like, okay, there was this one time Tammy had a red slinky dress, and it was Halloween, and she was like, here, try this on. And I was like, I just can't do the cross-dressing thing. This is, yeah, I was looking good in that dress, though. Yeah.
I can't imagine you looking fabulous. But... yeah, I think
that's when I shaved. I had a shaved face then. It was great. Yeah.
Yeah, that would help. That would help.
Anyway. Hi there. Yeah. So on that video front, there were people who they were part of the message of that was that guys are horrible in our culture and that all that. And others made similar videos in other cities, not New York. So it could be a cultural thing in New York, because these other places, someone put on clothes that were at least as nice as that girl, walked around with a backpack and the person behind her with a camera, and got zero attention. It was like hours of walking around, no harassment, no wolf whistles and all that, just, you know, people being pleasant.
Yeah.
And that goes back to, I think, maybe depending on the context, like in the office, it's generally inappropriate to tell someone they look really hot, unless you're really close with them, you know, close friends. But to tell someone, hey, that's a really handsome dress you've got on. That in most places I've worked, that's perfectly normal and
a
not creepy.
A handsome dress.
Nice. No, you look great dress. In that dress.
Yeah, like
well,
there's a difference between
I'm
hot.
I'm trying to choose a term that's not. Yeah. I want to take you out back kind of thing. It's like, no. I'm just trying to tell you, you look really nice, and they're probably trying to look nice. So
yeah, there's a difference between hot and pretty, right? Pretty would be appropriate in a workplace context. Hot would not be, unless it's a close friend that you have that kind of relationship.
Yeah.
yeah. Now I will say, like, I can look as nice as I want, but if I'm next to Arthur shirtless, like, he's getting all the attention. So. Which I think is well earned, but
yeah, he's earned it.
I know. I haven't worked that hard, so anyway.
Speaking of which,
yeah. So I'm
so
pretty sure, like,
on.
I wonder how much trouble I'll get in for that answer overall. We'll see.
Well, they were talking about how you're sanctioning sexual harassment in the workplace and all sorts of stuff here.
Yes.
So yeah, this just in. Yeah. You're just a troublemaker.
I am.
Okay, so on that front, tangential, in light of the evolving understanding of healthy eating from a paleo perspective, do you have a position on potatoes? Do you eat them?
So this is sort of funny. One of the things I like about paleo is that it's this like basic, it's this evolutionary framework, but it hasn't been stuck at, well, this is what Cornain said in his book, The Paleo Diet.
This is the one true way. Yeah.
Yeah, and so there's definitely been this evolving, hey, like, let's look at this again. Like, how bad really are legumes? How bad, like, are white potatoes really a problem? And so basically the – and also there was this association early on where paleo meant more low-carb paleo, and there's been a greater separation of that as well. Not that you can't do low-carb paleo, but that's just one option among many. So
in our part of the world, it tends to work out that, well, if you go paleo, you're going to be eating a lot less starchy, sugary stuff. So
that's sort of. But then
in other parts of the world, it's not true at all.
Well, it's certainly easy enough to eat a good bit of sweet potato and regular potatoes. And also, I think rice is actually quite benign. I don't have any problem with that. So it's not just that I'm pro potato. I think the case against potatoes is weak at best. I think from what I've read from on Whole Health Source when he did a series on it, basically you might want to avoid the skins, but other than that, you're all good.
And the same policy is that's what I stored as well, is that look, the potatoes and the rice don't want to be eaten either. They have defenses, and the defenses are in their shells. That's where they tend to be. And so if you want the starchy goodness, and sometimes I do, I want the starchy goodness, eat the peeled potato or eat the polished white rice, which is ironic because everybody thinks that's not the healthy one. It's like,
right.
Well, it doesn't have all the baddies.
Yeah,
I just want
the
starch.
I've done fine eating more potatoes, eating rice and so on. I don't have any ill effects from that. But I have been doing low-carb paleo again for the first time in like 5 years since SnowCon, so since the end of March. And that has been really, really fabulous for me. I've shed a bunch of fat. I built muscle. My energy levels are much more stable. So I don't have those crashes where I'm like, oh god, I need to eat. So
yeah, for us, really, eating clean is the standard of based on that evolutionary framework. So eating clean has nothing to do with how much starch. I take in. Starch is just a knob I turn for the effect I want. Like, am I training super hard and this is going to help my recovery? Or hey, maybe I want that starch because it's going to feel good. I'm going to enjoy my potatoes.
Yeah. Sweet potatoes. And
starchy goodness.
You miss those.
I know it's not going to hurt me in any fundamental way. It's a matter of aesthetics and how much pleasure I want this week. So yeah, I'm going to eat that potato. Versus, no, I want to lean out. Okay, fine. I need to lay off my tasty booze and potatoes.
Yes.
All right.
Booze and potatoes. Yeah, that's not an approved starch.
Yum. Yeah, I need to tighten up my diet. I've been enjoying things too much lately. Getting poofy.
Oh.
All right. Hey, in answer to a chat room question during a recent podcast, you said that there's no necessary connection, altruism and the concept of karma, because one will simply infuse karma with whatever basic ethical theory one holds. Isn't there more to it than that? Isn't karma an essential prop for altruism? In egoism, there's a clear bond between cause and effect. You enact certain virtues precisely because they lead to certain values. But in altruism, you're expected to act regardless of what of whether or not the results of your actions are of value to you. It seems to me that karma comes in to fill in the blank in order to answer all those pesky why questions. Why should I sacrifice my life by refusing to terminate a fetus with Down syndrome? Because karma will reward me for doing so. On all those life-altering choices down to giving a dollar to the panhandler, the concept of karma seems like a way of subverting careful, rational calculations of value. It's a thumb on the scale to tip any calculation in favor of whichever action would benefit others and away from whichever action would benefit myself. Interesting.
Yeah, I pretty much agree with this. There's a reason why I put that whole big question in the rapid fire queue, because I think somebody might have submitted it into the main queue, and I was like, there's not enough there for me to answer it. But like, dude, I think that like thumbs up. I think that's right. So basically, yes, this idea that karma can come in to fill in the blank in order to explain why you ought to be an altruist. I think that certainly can happen. And I don't think it's not necessary for altruism. You can certainly be a Kantian style altruism where you basically say, look, you should do it just because you must. And there's no rhyme or reason to it in the end. And you can also you can certainly combine karma with a basically kind of egoistic view. But I do think karma serves a purpose in altruistic theories that I think is really important and can certainly mean that they are a kind of ideological fit for each other in a way.
Interesting. Hey, you see this one right below it? I remember that question. This is kind of interesting. You want to hit it?
I can't remember. No, let's not do that one. Let's do a short one.
Okay.
Save that one for later. That's actually a pretty big rapid fire question.
Oh, going up. Need a short one. Well, this could be short or not. Hey, in a free society, would government bonds be a good way of funding the state, or would that infringe on the separation of state and economy?
I have no idea. Like, I don't have a super clear idea about how government bonds work. I don't think there's well worked out views about exactly how government financing would work. Like, what would be the limits? But certainly, if a government wishes to, like, let's say we had a fully free society and voluntary taxation and so on, and you have like World War II, you know, like we need to go fight Hitler, and that there's, let's say, I mean, there's a genuine necessity and it's going to be a big war and so on, right? If that's the case, it might be that government bonds are like a way of getting you over the hump in terms of getting financing. I don't know, and that might be important.
It might have been sort of their version of crowdfunding for like, hey, we've got a war effort right now, and this is the way to chip in.
Right. But the problem is, I mean, I think it's really different if you have a system of voluntary taxation versus compulsory taxation. Bonds in compulsory taxation, which is what we have now, basically just mean more future taxes, right? But if you're doing voluntary taxation, you can just say, look, like, we know that like funds are tight for everybody right now, so what we're going to do is bank on future productivity, and that's what, you know, that's we all know that this will be the way of making this work. So
we should probably take up the government financing in a free society question as a full question. That would be,
I think we might,
that would be an interesting one to work through.
Yeah. Craig Biddle, I know, has an article on it from the Objective Standard that might also be worth looking up for people. And obviously Ayn Rand's article in The Virtue of Selfishness is well worth reading for people who are like, what? Voluntary taxation? What? Yeah.
Makes no sense.
Yeah.
Brain hurting.
I know.
Yeah, that's it's much like if the government didn't give us shoes, what are we going to walk around barefoot? You can't do that. Okay, moving on. Because it's time for us to sign off from another episode of Philosophy in Action Radio. Thanks for listening. We hope you all had a great time.
I had a good time. Once again, thank you to our generous contributors. With every episode of Philosophy in Action Radio, we bring you ideas that engage the mind and help you live better. Plus, we introduce thousands of other listeners to the principles they need to live virtuous, happy, and free lives. We think that's hugely important, and we do depend on your support. So if you want to contribute, just go to philosophyinaction.com/support.
Wonderful. Remember, we welcome feedback on what we're doing well and what we could do better, too. Just email all that feedback to diana@philosophyinaction.com.
If you do want to see what's on tap for the next few weeks, visit philosophyinaction.com/upcoming.
I'm Greg Perkins, and you can find me online at objectivismseminar.com. This show features Dr. Diana Shea, and you can read her blog, Noodle Food, at philosophyinaction.com/blog. Please drop by to submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows, and then join us live here at the same time next week at philosophyinaction.com.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.